It is not our purpose to try to contain China or to hold China down. What we are trying to do is to uphold the international rules-based order.
High-level discussions on climate and China. It's Thursday, May 6th. This is VOA Asia. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Find us online, VOA Asia Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and YouTube. Also ahead, another vaccine campaign begins. An Afghan leader speaks with VOA on Taliban and U.S. withdrawal. The business of grooming and toys. High tech for everyone. Indonesia's little free libraries. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Foreign ministers of the G7 group of industrialized nations are meeting in London this week, with climate change, Russia, and as you may have guessed, China among the topics for discussion. Henry Ridgewell reports from London.
Face to face, for the first time in 2 years, G7 foreign ministers remained socially distanced as they met in London Tuesday. There is a full agenda for the two-day summit, including the G7's relations with Russia, which was ejected from the group after its forceful annexation of Crimea in 2014. G7 ministers condemned Moscow's recent deployment of troops on Ukraine's border.
If Russia chooses to act recklessly or aggressively, we'll respond. But we're not looking to escalate. We would prefer to have a more stable, more predictable relationship.
China is also high on the agenda.
It is not our purpose to try to contain China or to hold China down. What we are trying to do is to uphold the international rules-based order.
Chinese state media accused the United States Tuesday of, in its words, deliberately hyping up the so-called China threat. The G7 is upholding the principles enshrined at its foundation in 1975, says analyst John Curtin.
To protect within its own members and promote globally the values of open democracy and individual liberty. They were very much threatened by an expanding Russia above all in 1975. And they're still threatened by Russia today, but also China and other authoritarian regimes.
Britain also invited foreign ministers from Australia, India, South Africa and South Korea to the talks, a demonstration of London's focus on the Indo-Pacific region.
So what we are seeing is the birth of a broader democratic family, and if they're willing to put their country's name on paper alongside the democratic seven, the G7 itself, that will be an even more powerful signal.
G7 foreign ministers also discussed a coordinated response to the military coup in Myanmar and the violent crackdown on pro-democracy protests, and the US and NATO pullout from Afghanistan, which began this month.
Making sure that we preserve the ability to deal with counterterrorism, that the gains that were hard won in Afghanistan are not lost, and also ultimately promoting dialogue and a peace process that benefits all Afghans.
Meanwhile, campaigners are calling on the G7 to ensure that poorer countries get access to coronavirus vaccines. The United Nations says close to 90% of all vaccines administered worldwide have gone to richer nations. The response to the pandemic will be a focus when Britain hosts the G7 Leaders Summit in June, set to be Joe Biden's first overseas visit as US President. Henry Ridgewell for VOA News, London.
We invite you to find out more on our top story and all the stories you hear on today's VOA Asia program by following our Twitter stream at VOA Asia, also on Facebook at VOA Asia, and we invite you to stop by our website. That's voanews.com. These are among some of the top Asia headlines you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Australia faces court challenge to India travel ban. Indian diaspora in United States heartbroken as COVID surges in India. U.S. Customs sees Malaysian firm's medical gloves after forced labor finding. U.S. presses Taliban to ease violence, resume peace talks. Taiwan's Star Wars fans celebrate unofficial holiday atop nation's tallest building. Expanded coverage of these stories and much more can be found daily. We're at Facebook at VOA Asia and the VOAnews.com website. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. There's much more VOA Asia to come. Right now, the first phase of the COVID-19 vaccine rollout has begun in Papua New Guinea, as infection numbers continue to rise. Experts say Australia's nearest neighbor is also fighting a sea of misinformation and concerns over the safety of vaccines. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Experts say misinformation about COVID-19 is spreading even faster in Papua New Guinea than the disease. Conspiracy theories and other falsehoods have found fertile ground online, adding to a sense of mistrust at deeply held beliefs in sorcery. Aid workers have reported that the family of a health worker in Papua New Guinea who tested positive for the virus was tortured by relatives fearful of unexplained illness. Jonathan Pryke is the director of the Pacific Islands program at the Lowy Institute, a Sydney-based research organization. He says hoaxes spread on social media about the novel coronavirus add to the confusion.
Facebook is where you get all of your information from, and Facebook is just seeding misinformation, and misinformation is spreading faster than the virus in that country.
The World Health Organization reported 11,206 COVID-19 cases and 115 deaths Tuesday in Papua New Guinea. Pryke believes the true scale of the pandemic in the Pacific Island nation is far worse because of a lack of testing, and patients with symptoms refuse or fear retaliation from within their communities, preventing them from seeking treatment. Prior to the pandemic, sorcery-related violence against victims has been rampant in the country, according to news reports.
The official statistics don't look as serious as the true picture is. And, you know, there's a lot of data points you can look at that display just how serious this is. We've had a sitting member of parliament die. We've had two judges die. It's bad. It's a health system that is so stretched to breaking point that it really can't handle this shock. We're seeing this crisis play out in front of our very eyes.
The pandemic has been felt differently across the Pacific. Some countries have so far escaped unscathed. According to the World Health Organization, Tonga hasn't recorded any infection since the pandemic began. Samoa has had just a single confirmed case, and three cases have been recorded in Vanuatu. Fiji has recorded more than 100 coronavirus infections, and two people have died, WHO reported. A mass inoculation program is underway in French Polynesia. So far, there have been almost 19,000 cases detected and 141 deaths in the past 15 months. However, it is reopening its international borders only to vaccinated travellers from the United States, who've already tested negative for COVID. The U.S. territory of Guam has reported its latest figures, with 7,700 infections and 136 deaths due to the pandemic. Currently, Guam has a 14-day quarantine period in place for all passengers entering through air or sea. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, Thai health officials rush to vaccinate people in one of the most impoverished neighborhoods of Bangkok as a new surge in COVID-19 cases spread through densely populated low-income areas. Stay up to date with VOA and VOA 60. You're listening to VOA Asia. We hope you're having a nice day, and it's getting off to a great start with us at VOA Asia. The United States and its NATO allies have officially begun withdrawing their remaining forces and equipment from Afghanistan. Abdullah Abdullah, the chairman of Afghanistan's High Council for National Reconciliation, discussed the implications for Afghanistan's peace process and the future of the country with VOA's Ayesha Tanzim.
Dr. Abdullah, thank you so much for joining us. The U.S. and NATO have started withdrawing their forces from Afghanistan. Do you fear an increase in violence?
There is always a possibility of that. Should Taliban choose to increase violence with the hope that they can take advantage of that situation, that's a possibility. And I hope that they are not making that mistake.
How do you think this announcement of a withdrawal will impact your negotiations with the Taliban?
In natural circumstances, when these sorts of situations takes place, and one side which thinks that because of the vacuum that the withdrawal leaves, it may be able to take advantage of that situation, that emboldens the position of the sides. The one which is which thinks more on the military term rather than peaceful means. And that's the concern, that Taliban position might get further emboldened. Well, as far as their excuses or the reasons that they were giving, that it's because of the presence of the international forces, it's jihad against the foreigners and so on and so forth. So in 3 months' time, perhaps even less than 3 months' time, there will be no foreign troops in our soil.
What's the status of Doha negotiations? They seem to have stalled.
Recently, with the announcement of the withdrawal, before September 11, the Taliban position has changed. They say that they have gone to their chief negotiator, has gone to Pakistan to consult with their leaders and to take directions from them, to take instruction about it, to shape up their position. What they would do from today onward, which is 1st of May, because earlier their position was that we were going to attack the international forces. So as far as Doha process is concerned, we still believe that it's important, and also other opportunities like Turkey, the meeting in Turkey. Of course, it has to be a meaningful event. Both sides needs to work beforehand in order to make it more effective.
You mentioned the Turkey conference, the Istanbul conference as it's known. The Taliban are refusing to come. So A, why are they refusing to come? And do you think even after Eid, if they don't come, there will be an Istanbul conference?
Well, if they don't come to a meeting which is supposed to be between both sides and supported by the international community, of course, this will be a new situation. The conference will not take place. They haven't said that they are not coming. They haven't said that they are coming. And that has been the difficulty in negotiating with the Taliban throughout. They leave their position very vague. They give different impressions to different different interlocutors. And then as a result of such an attitude, the time in Doha was not best utilized.
We hear more from Abdullah Abdullah, chairman of Afghanistan's High Council for National Reconciliation, speaking with VOA's Ayesha Tanzim on tomorrow's VOA Asia.
VOA Asia Facebook is the choice of millions to see and read the latest stories about Asia and the United States. Follow us on VOA Asia Facebook and say hello online or on your smartphone. Subscribe to all of our platforms for free. See, hear, and read and share all of the latest from VOA Asia anytime. VOA Asia is your trusted source for news and great features.
This news from VOA Asia. World Athletics President Sebastian Coe said test events are absolutely crucial to the success of the Tokyo Olympics after observing a run-through Wednesday of COVID-19 countermeasures for the marathon event in Sapporo. You'll find this in all the big stories on VOA Asia Twitter and Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Up next on VOA Asia, looking your best and big money in toys. These are the topics on this week's VOA Asia Business Scene. Here's Josh Nist.
Male makeup brands in Japan have seen a surge in business since the start of the pandemic. Industry leaders believe the reason behind this is that men want to look well-groomed during video conference calls. Eichmann Works, a makeup salon for men, says its revenue has jumped 25% over the last year. Takumi Tezuka, the founder and CEO of Eichmann Works, says older customers play a vital role in the growth of his business.
Men in their 40s, 50s, and 60s come to our salon because they feel it's necessary for them to wear makeup. Such, the rate of cancellation is low and the repeat rate is high. They also tend to spend more money than the younger ones.
To make cosmetics more accessible to men, Japanese cosmetic store Cosme Tokyo created an entire section dedicated to male and unisex makeup items last year. Kenta Yamazaki, a customer at the store, thinks it's a step in the right direction, but thinks there's room for improvement.
I think there are men who cannot buy cosmetic products because it's hard for them to casually drop in. I think it's nice we now have this section, but I wish they could make this section bigger so that men can casually drop in.
While so many shops had to take financial hits during the pandemic, the male makeup industry has been able to blossom in Japan. Blind boxes have made toy makers a fortune with their strong appeal to toy collectors. The toys were first popularized in Japan, but in recent years, China has become a booming second-hand market. An unopened blind box typically costs $10 to $20. However, rare figures can resell for much more. Similar to collecting baseball cards, customers are not sure which blind box figurine they get until they open the packaging, from fairies to miniature King Kongs. Wan Zhaozhu, a student, says she enjoys collecting the miniature toys.
I think the fun of the blind box is like playing a game. You need to shake it, feel the box, and deduce what's inside.
The blind box market was worth 7.4 billion yuan, or about 1 billion US dollars in 2019. But according to market research firm Qianjian Intelligence, the market could skyrocket to 30 billion yuan, or 4.6 billion US dollars by 2024. Live streamers are also helping popularize the fist-sized toys by going online and broadcasting their box-opening adventures. But the craze has not escaped criticism, with state media comparing the trend to gambling and warning the product's bred addiction. Some have even called for more regulations, insisting the boxes should not be sold blindly. For Business Scene, I'm Josh Nist.
Stay with VOA Asia, as a simple but high-tech device is helping to improve people's health in areas with little or no tech. And the little libraries that are telling a big learning story for Indonesian children. Making headlines in Asia, police have arrested a man they say is suspected of stabbing two Asian American women in San Francisco's mid-market area in another targeted attack on Asian Americans that activists say have increased in California and other parts of the United States. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, ultrasound technology provides a crucial window into patients' health, but it's often inaccessible in developing countries. Now, a handheld ultrasound device could be a game-changer for the developing world, as Tina Trin tells us.
In Nairobi, Kenya, this expectant mother is getting a glimpse of the future, courtesy of a device called the Butterfly IQ.
Butterfly IQ is the world's first single-probe, whole-body ultrasound system.
The $2,000 handheld ultrasound device works with both iOS and Android mobile devices to provide medical imaging in real time.
So instead of being sent off for a test, you pull a test right out of the pocket.
Butterfly was one of 17 digital health winners in the Global Tech Challenge, an initiative between the World Bank Group and the Consumer Technology Association. This year's challenge focused on solutions for improving healthcare access in East Africa.
Our model before Butterfly is we had one ultrasound, and this was something that would actually move in a taxi from clinic to clinic.
Melissa Menke is the founder of Access Afia, a network of healthcare clinics within the informal settlements of Nairobi that began testing Butterfly IQ last fall. Menke says Butterfly IQ's teleguidance feature is a game changer.
Where a woman can sit with a clinical officer, so this is more of a junior doctor, and he or she can hold the probe, provide the service. Our expert on the other end can draw on the image, can circle things, can say, do you see this?
Menke says the device has allowed frontline staff to do more, but admits there is a learning curve.
You have people who are not trained, you know, to be sonographers, to be radiologists. So we made a huge upfront investment in training. Butterfly is a great online library that helped with that.
The need is urgent in Kenya, where high maternal mortality rates still plague mothers-to-be.
But at the same time, about 90% of the complications can be detected through good lab work and good ultrasound.
For these patients, it's a window into a brighter, healthier future. Tina Trin, VOA News.
Inspired by a growing trend in the United States, some villagers in Indonesia have set up free libraries to foster the love of reading and learning among local children. As VOA's Vina Mubtadi reports, there were some unique challenges to overcome in Indonesia to make the project work.
Small wooden boxes like these have become a common sight in American neighborhoods. Visitors can take a book or leave a book. In Indonesia, free libraries are rare, especially in rural communities. But they seemed like a great idea to Nining Dwi Astuti, a civil servant who lives in central Java. With the support of local officials and fellow villagers, she built the only registered little free library in the area.
Many people ask, how do we borrow a book? Who do we return the book to? I said, just take it, and if you want to return it, just put it back. They were kind of surprised.
Her little blue box was a hit with villagers. It is now a learning hub for local children.
I come here to study, read books, and borrow books.
Seeing children drawn to her free library, Dwi Astuti decided to take it a step further.
In the village, the internet is limited. Many people don't have internet at home. They use internet tokens. The quota is also limited. We took the initiative to install Wi-Fi at home, so children would borrow books in the morning and study there at night.
Elsewhere in central Java, a local teacher, Ari Hendra Permana, repurposed used furniture to set up his own little free library.
Nowadays, children seldom read books. Instead, they play games. The target of the library is children.
Since he set up the free library in 2019, children of all ages congregate on Permana's front porch. Many books are torn and damaged because they are borrowed so often.
This one was glued earlier, but now it's torn again.
Ideally, a little free library functions by allowing kids to not only borrow books, but also to donate them, resulting in steady circulation. But this is difficult to achieve in villages where the literacy level is low. To overcome the problem, Dwi Astuti and Permana rely on donations and purchase books using their own money.
I received book donations from friends and colleagues. I also received a grant from the village.
To buy books, I have to travel at least 45 kilometers to downtown Cilacap because there are no bookstores around here.
For both of them, it's a small sacrifice that makes a big difference for their communities. Vina Mubtadi, VOA News.
Time for us to close the book on this edition of VOA Asia. We invite you to come back again tomorrow. In the meantime, we're online. Follow us on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and our Facebook page at VOA Asia. We also thank our team that brings you this program, Service Chief Diane Gao, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Amy Hybels. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a great day ahead. Be safe. Be well.